Okay, so the first topic of this session is on Lost Cambridge, which Anton is going to tell us all about.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming along to this presentation. This is very much touching on a number of things that John Sheridan said and spoke to us about earlier today. And I wanted to basically showcase some of the things that I found out using, I guess, all things digital on researching the history of Cambridge. Now, when I talk about Cambridge, I'm talking about my hometown. I'm not talking about the university, because there have been thousands and thousands of books written about the university and its academics and its students, but very little comparatively has been written about the town. And it was going through, in particular, the digital newspaper archives that I found out that actually we've got a really wonderful history. And I dare say that in other towns and cities, just going through some of the old newspaper archives, you'd find some absolutely wonderful things. Now, this group of chaps here, these are some of the earliest volunteer soldiers that Cambridge had. These are the Cambridgeshire Rifles, and they're standing outside Downing College in about 1867. Now, what got me into this, I just wanted to put this slide together to get you thinking about what things come to mind when we think about local history. Because when I did GCSE history, it was sold really badly to me. It was about digging in muddy fields, finding bits of pots, and it didn't really compare with the great battles of the great dictators of the 19th and 20th century. As far as Cambridge is concerned, we have, or people like me have grown up under the shadow of the university, and so therefore everything that has been written really about Cambridge as a town or as a place, certainly from my perspective, has kind of been a bit part to that, which I think is a shame. Now, what really got me into this was when I stumbled across this photograph. We have a number of very passionate local historians in the city, and this one is Cambridge historian Isfons Chamberlain, named after the character in Happy Days. And this photograph is the old Shire House on Market Square. And it got me thinking, how did that get there, and also how did we get to the Guildhall that we currently have? Because as for those of you at the front can see, you've got lots of people in contemporary outfits. There are no cars there, and there are no market stalls there, which differs greatly from what it was like during the Second World War and then also to today. During the 1800s, Cambridge was expanding rapidly, far more rapidly than it currently is, even though it's still expanding hugely for those of us that live there. This was the first design for a new Guildhall in 1857. And again, I found this on an architectural archive called Archiseek. And from here, it looks quite magnificent. I'd be quite proud to have a building like that today. But going through the paper archives, where everything's done in manuscript, in beautiful writing that I can barely read, it seems like they couldn't get the finances to make ends meet, in part because some of the market stall holders refused to budge. Fast forward to 1893, and we have another design. Now, this design got thrown out because it was not seen as grand enough for Cambridge. It was just like, no, sorry, too small. And then the architect, John Belcher, came up with this wonderful, wonderful masterpiece in 1898. And guess what happened here? We didn't get that one either. The reason why we didn't get that one, and I found this out from the digital newspaper archives of the Cambridge Independent, is because the councillors felt they could not make the political case to spend all of the money on what would have been a wonderful wedding cake. And so they put it out to a local referendum of ratepayers, and they said, we're spending far too much money on roads and sewers, you can't have your Guildhall. And so basically, what it would have looked like is very similar to what Colchester Town Hall have, just much bigger, because Belcher actually completed Colchester Town Hall. If you ever go to Colchester, do have a look at that town hall, it's wonderful. But as I said, for nearly 80 years, the great and the good, all men, because in those days, women were not allowed to be on the council, struggled with costs and designs of Guildhall until Florence steps in. How many of you have heard of Florence Ada Keynes before? How many of you have heard of John Maynard Keynes before? Right, good. John Maynard Keynes, founding father of macroeconomics. Florence is so much more than John's mum. Florence, I've given her the title the mother of modern Cambridge because that is what she is. But so little has been written about her. And what she did, as I've stated up there, she was the first woman elected to Cambridge Borough Council in 1914. She got the law changed in order to become a councillor. Because in those days, married women were not allowed to be councillors. They changed the law some 7-8 years previously to allow unmarried women to stand for election, but not married ones. But when the war broke out, they said, OK, go on then. She founded a number of organisations which we know and are still around today. The Cambridge Boys Labour Exchange, which is aimed at teenage boys and then one for the girls, was the first job centre set up in the country. And it was someone else I'm going to come on to later who actually ran it for her. Became mayor of Cambridge in 1932. And when she became mayor, she said, we're going to sort this Guildhall problem out. And so when the final designs came about, the town were not happy. They were just like, this is just far too bland, we're not having it. At the age of 75, she faced down all of her critics and we got the Guildhall built. And that's it. So in about 5 years, Florence Ada Keynes managed to achieve, as an old age pensioner, what the great men of Cambridge had failed to achieve in 80 years. And I think that's quite a good record. It's just a shame we've got no statues and no plaques and no nothing to pay testament to what she did. Now, one of the things that cropped up that a lot of people forget about our Guildhall is you can see the clock at the top, but we have these two little bundles of fun next to it. See the cockerel and the owl? Cockerel is called Dawn and the owl is called Dusk. And nobody knows the story behind those two, so if anybody has any ideas as to who decided to put those two there, please let us know. Now, the main point of all of this, really, for me, is about the newspaper archives and the importance of them, because the British Newspaper Archive is going through the process of digitising pretty much every single newspaper in the British Library. And more importantly, it allows you to do keyword searches. And so if I do a keyword search of Mrs. Keynes and Cambridge, you'll get lots of newspaper articles about her work. It's still work in progress for them. So the time when she spent a lot of her years as a councillor in the 20s and 30s, I don't have access to, so I have to go through all the microfiches. But in those days, yes, you had adverts for weird things that could not be proved. So you have all of these weird and wonderful pills that claim they will cure ringworm, cracked lips, scalp sores and chafings and things like that, but don't actually work because they didn't have advertising standards in those days. But, and this is the real critical thing, certainly from a perspective of a local historian, is that major meetings and court cases, full transcripts were published. Now, if you are a teacher wanting to dramatise something for your children, you don't need to write a play, you just have to go to the newspaper and it's all there for you. So in Cambridge in 1875, when we opened the Corn Exchange, still today the biggest indoor building in public building in Cambridge, the Cambridge undergraduates had a riot on that day, so much so that 8 of them ended up in court, and the Cambridge Independent has the full transcript. It is beautiful. A day later, those students went round, or the friends of those students ran round to the mayor's house and promptly put out every single window in them, so outraged they were at the stiff sentences were put down. Data. This is one of the other things that's really useful in those newspapers. And you can see at the top, Saturday, 13th of January, 1866. Adam Brooks Hospital, now today one of the biggest hospitals in the country, was publishing data on a weekly basis of its patients in terms of who was coming in, who was going out, and also, because in those days hospitals weren't run by the state, donations. So when I tipped off Adam Brooks all about this, they thought, well, this is interesting, and also said the same to the police. I said, look, Cambridge Independent, annual figures for all of the crimes that were committed in Cambridge. Assaults on police, cruelty to animals, Elementary Education Act, motor cars. So, again, in those days, and this one is from the First World War, because before the First World War, 1905, we're talking 23 offences of related to motoring, which is quite astonishing. But this is now what they're doing. Adam Brooks and Cambridge Police are now publishing data, just like we used to in the Cambridge Independent all those decades ago. How many of you would have thought for a city hospital like Cambridge, or rather a regional hospital like Cambridge, we'd have 2,000 A&E cases coming in every week? Is that low? Is that higher? Is that in terms of what you would expect for a hospital? 97 broken bones, is that a lot? Is that not many? I'm seeing lots of shoulder shrugs, but my point being is that as local residents, as taxpayers, you now have an idea of what the demands are on public services. I dread to think what they're going through today with... Well, actually, no, because Adam Brooks, fortunately, has avoided the NHS hack. Now, walking into the archives, it's not just all things digital. One of the great things that you can do is you can put two and two together and say, OK, let's see where all of these other archives are. And it was in one archive, that's me in a video clip I made, of a book that's called Cambridge, A Brief Study in Social Questions, which I found out through the archives, written by E. Jebb. Does anyone know who E. Jebb is? No, because I didn't have a clue either when I made that video. Turns out E. Jebb is this wonderful woman. How many of you have heard of Save the Children? Yeah, she founded it. But before she founded it, she spent 10 years in Cambridge writing the first social scientific study of poverty and multiple deprivation in Cambridge, at a time when all of the academics and the clerics in Cambridge said the problem of poverty and multiple deprivation in Cambridge is due to women with loose morals. Eglantine went to the slums in Cambridge, interviewed all of the interviewed people there, did studies of the houses and the plans and the courtyards, and said the big problem is town planning and lack of public services. It's not ladies with loose morals. She didn't write it alone. She had some very influential people working with her. Clara Rackham was one of the first women councillors elected to Cambridge. Mrs. Alfred Marshall, that's Mary Paley Marshall, one of the first women professors of economics. And Florence Ada Keynes, who I mentioned earlier. For me, this is the most important thing stemming from that, and it's a forgotten story, is that, one, her book changed government policy, both locally and nationally. Two, the Internet Archive has that book available for free. You can go and read it. It's wonderful. And the reason why, for me, this matters, as I mentioned earlier, is because up until 1894, young women in Cambridge were being arrested by university authorities on the grounds that the authorities thought they were sex workers. It took a 17-year-old, Daisy Hopkins, to change the law when she stood up to them. And again, the transcripts of the court cases are in the newspapers, and it's a wonderful read. And again, Daisy Hopkins' story is a wonderful one of actually how women stood up to the authorities. So there is a quick rush through, really, of kind of like Victorian, Edwardian, interwar Cambridge, and how that group of women, and there are lots more with them, including people from the Darwin family, made the Cambridge that we know today. Thank you.
Before we disappear, does anyone want to ask any questions? Okay, let's move on. Thanks very much. Right. So, Dave, Tower Bridge. When can I see Tower Bridge over?
Actually, we will answer that question later on. I should point out there is actually code in this talk, and it's Perl code, but I'll try and get through it as quickly as possible. So the talk's called Freeing Tower Bridge, but it has a subtitle. It's 2017, Why the Fuck Are We Still Scraping Websites? And we'll come to that a bit later on. I want to start with a bad Londoner confession. See, I've lived in London for 35 years, more than 35 years. That's not the confession. And all that time, this is a confession, in all that time I'd never seen Tower Bridge lift. No, it's an iconic London structure. I've just never been in the right place, at that place, at the right time. But then, at the start of this year, I started doing some work for Zoopla, who were hiring, and they've asked me to point that out. And for those of you that don't know, so this is obviously Tower Bridge going through the middle of the photo here, and the Zoopla head office is actually, it's very close. It's the building is called the Cooperage because it's where John Courage used to make the barrels for his beer, so that's handy. So at least I now have some geographical convenience.
Price Tower Bridge then?
You can have to look it up on the website. I'm not sure you'll find it. So this gives me an opportunity. All I need is some kind of notification because I'm literally 2 or 3 minutes walk from being able to see the bridge. So what I'm thinking of is I need some kind of data feed which goes through to my Android phone and then makes my Pebble watch beep, and then I can get up from my desk and walk the 3 minutes it takes me. And profit in some unspecified way. So what I need is some data. Tower Bridge have a Twitter feed, but you can read it as much as you like, and it's all marketing bollocks. There's no useful data there whatsoever. They have a website. Again, most of the website is about trying to get you to pay money to go and visit the bridge. Actually, I did that last week. It's well worth the tenner it costs to get in. But on the website, they have a page showing the bridge lift up. There's also, you'll see, there's a link to book a bridge lift, and I did think that might be an easier way of being in the right place at the right time, but I haven't tried that yet. If you page down on this page, then you'll actually get the list of the upcoming lifts. But again, no data in a format. I mean, what I was really hoping for was maybe an iCal feed or an RSS feed or some JSON or something like that. Nothing like that, just text in a table. So it looks like I've got to do it myself, which is where we come back to the... but at least things have got better since 20 years ago when I used to do a lot of this kind of stuff. And Perl has good tools like web query, where I can write code like this, which you're not interested in. But basically, I get back a data structure which contains all the information that was in that table. I have to manage that data in some way into an iCal feed and profit. Well, I found a Perl module called Data iCal, which models an iCal file, and it has there's another module for events, so that's all good. So I'm going to write a piece of code where I create a new iCal object for each of the lifts that I've got. I do something with the date, and I end up with an object that contains all the information, and then I just print it out as a string. Easy. But let's take a closer look at this list of the lift times. Look at the first entry on this list. I hope you can see at the back. There's something kind of obvious missing from that data. Anyone?
Yeah.
It doesn't have the year. So this led me to writing ridiculous code like this, saying, assume it's the current year, and then create a date time object from that string, and then look at the month and see if the month is in the past, then we actually must be the next year. So increment the year and start again. But it works. I also wrote this because I found there were duplicates appearing in the list, which kind of makes me think that the website is actually just someone typing stuff in at a terminal. So we end up with something like this, which vaguely works. But then I took another detour. If we look at the first two items on this list, now I know the fact that there are many weeks gap in between that. One thing that I've learned is that they don't tend to put some of the lifts on the list until quite soon before, so you quite often see quite large gaps. But there's another weird thing about these two dates. They're in different time zones. Well, I assume they're in different time zones because they don't tell me which time zone that they're in. But if we look at them, the first one's probably in UTC, and the second one, because it's after the end of March, is probably British summertime. So I have to deal with that. Well, that's no problem because time zones are easy. That's irony. So I just tell that my date parser that I'm dealing with Europe, London, and then I print out the time zone, and that failed validation. There's a really useful site that validates your iCal feed, and I wish more people used it. So then I found another Perl module that claimed to format my date time object as iCal, and it printed out something that looked like this. That looked pretty sane to me, but again, it failed the validation with an error message saying it was an invalid TZID. Now, the TZID is this bit, and now if you know anything at all about dates and times, you'll know that that is a valid key into the Olsen database of dates and times. But I didn't understand why it didn't validate, so as a last resort, I decided I'd better read the standards, which says, you don't need to read that, or that, but basically what it's saying is that the TZID key is not a key into the Olsen database, it's a key that points to a different part of your iCal file, which contains all of the information that you should find in the Olsen database. So basically I've got to reproduce the entire Olsen database for London in my iCal file. So I've got to add this section to the iCal file. So I found a module that did this, but the documentation said, well, the first line, this module is not yet useful. Basically, it's not implemented. It doesn't cover the V time zone section that I wanted, which made me sad. So plan C, I went back to the standard documentation again, and I found that you can actually just put a date time in without any time zone information. Now, that makes me really sad, very scared at doing that. But, hey, it worked. For the first time ever, I had an iCal feed that validated. So that was cause for a celebration. But it stopped working in the last week of March because Google Calendar, which is what I was using, assumed that it was all UTC, and I was turning up for bridge lifts an hour late. So we really do need that time zone section, so if in doubt, steal one from the internet. So I found one, which I don't really understand it, but it kind of looks like it makes sense, because it says things like the standard time goes from an offset of plus one to an offset of zero, and it happens in the 10th month. And there's a thing saying minus one SU, so I kind of think that means the last Sunday in the month. So it looks vaguely sane. But then I had to kind of hack that into my code. And if you know any Perl, you know that this is the worst Perl code you've ever seen. It kind of makes me think of that old XKCD cartoon about how God created the universe in Lisp. Well, that was the plan, but in the end, he hacked it together in Perl. So anyway, it works. So we throw together a website which looks a bit like that. It's at towerbridge.dave.org.uk. There are links at the bottom to the iCal file, which now does work. And there's also a JSON file if anybody wants to do something cleverer. We rebuild it daily because I'm not entirely sure how often that chap sits there and updates the website. The code's on GitHub if anybody wants to laugh at it. Subscribe to the calendar and profit, because this is a photo that I took on the 13th of February in my lunch hour. Yay. I just want to quickly mention some prior art, because I've discovered that someone called Tom Armitage did the same thing back in 2008. Well, he put up a Twitter feed, which was the bridge talking to you. It said, "I am lifting now, and I am going down." I don't think it said that. And then 3 years later, he got emails from people saying, "What happened to your Twitter bot?" And he dug into it and found that Tower Bridge had taken it off, had taken control of it off him. They didn't bother to tell him. They just went to Twitter and said, "This person is impersonating us." So to try and avoid that, I sent a tweet to Tower Bridge and told them exactly what I was doing. And the reply I got was, "Well, we've already got all of the stuff on our website." And they include a link. They helpfully gave me a link to their page on their website, which I mentioned on my website is where I'm scraping all the data from. Social media people, sometimes. Anyway, to answer the question that someone asked right at the start, there are 4 lifts this evening. At 6, at 7, at 11:15, and even out really late, just before midnight. Now that's what I went back in, since so long ago now, in March, when Sam started to ask for talks for this. This was the project that I was working on. Since then, things have changed rather. Some of you might have seen me two years ago talking about Twit Election, a website that I run that has 650 Twitter lists, one for each constituency. And so this is kind of more important to me right now. So if you take anything away from my talk, please visit this. Anyway, I've got my photo, so I'm happy. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Dave?
Yeah.
Sorry, what was the name of the GUI module you used for scraping?
It was web query, web :: query. Anyone else? Okay.
No, right, let's move on.
Thanks very much.
Once again.
Right. Hey, people at the back, do you want to come up the front? There's more seats.
No.
Okay, so my name's Mia. I work at the British Library, but I'm not speaking in an official capacity, just in case I get ranty, and also in case anyone wants to ask me about why you have to pay money to access the newspaper archive. So I'm talking about curators versus robots, because that's one of the issues that concerns me at the moment. I'm a curator. I'm a digital curator, though. I have degrees in computer science, human-computer interaction, and history. So it's a kind of perfect place for me to be, and probably one of the only places that I could do that kind of work. So the question is really, how do we help you find that one in 200 million item? If you're coming to the library, there might only be one thing that you're interested in, one thing that can answer the question that you really want to answer, one thing that might be about your street 200 years ago. And we want to help you do that, but the backlog of cataloguing is huge, so it's decades away before we get to that point. So how can we use technology to make it easier for people to find their own heritage? And a bit of context on why we need this. I've worked in a lot of cultural organisations. Some of them have had like trays that contain millions of ants cumulatively, hundreds of thousands of bits of Roman pottery or flasks used in medicine. But the British Library's collections are probably one of the biggest in the world. Don't listen to Wikipedia, it's not the Library of Congress. There's about 200 million items, no one really knows. And that's partly because it depends how you count an item. There's about 4 million books, 14 million books, 4 million maps, 60 million patents. Hopefully you get the size of the material that we're working with. So it means that everything we do takes a long time. And it's really hard to make an impact on any sort of one part of the collection, because you finish a project, you digitise everything, you do a wonderful job, and then you kind of look up and you realise that Everest is still looming over you. We're continuing to add new items each year. We're ramping up At the moment, we ingest about 0.5 terabyte of data a day. We collect about 13 kilometres of new shelf material each year. And in about 5 years' time, we're looking to ingest 5 terabytes of data a day. So we're never going to keep up if we're trying to do things the manual way. And at any given point, only about 1% to 2% of the collections are digitised or born digital, because we're acquiring new material, even the material that does come in digital format. So the UK Web Archive still doesn't have metadata because people aren't very good at putting in meta headers and things that would describe a website so that it's easy to find, so it's easy to understand when it was created, who made it, why they made it, who else contributed content to it, etc. So there's a really big gap in what we try and offer people. And when I say that 1% to 2% of the collections are digitised or digital, we don't even have online catalogue records for everything that we hold. There is a crowdsourcing project, LibCrowds, if you want to help retro-convert old catalogue records. But the catalogue began at the British Museum a couple of hundred years ago, so the backlog is extensive in lots of different ways. So we're working on getting just everything to have a simple record online. That's a great start. Ideally, when people think about accessing the records of a library, they think they're going to get an image, a nice sort of viewable book, but often all we say is, come into the library and then you can read things. So we're working on getting digitised images of as many books and manuscripts as we can online. At the moment, there are about 310,000 books online that you can access via the catalogue or via Google Books. That's fantastic. That's really great. It's taken a long time to get to that point. But when you say that there are 14 million books, again, that's only a tiny drop in the ocean. And we're working as fast as we can. The digitising studios are at capacity constantly. They're buying new equipment all the time. But we can't keep up with the demand. So we have hopefully an image of a book, and that's great. You can sit there and you can read it on your screen, and it's kind of like being in the library. Ideally, we'd have some form of text based from that image. So it might be automatically transcribed text. And if you can see the text on the right-hand side, that's optical character recognition text. It's not amazing. If you're looking for Geelong, you're not going to find it. If you're looking for the west of England, then you're in luck, you'll find that. So some form of full-text search is possible, but it's kind of sketchy still. So sometimes you'll get amazingly handcrafted transcriptions that have been done, sort of double-keyed, two people have done them, or they might have been corrected using software or using crowdsourcing and other processes. There's also some metadata, so that's data about the items. Down on that bottom right-hand side, it's what the name of the book is, who wrote it, where it was published, when it was published, sometimes the publisher. That is often what you get in the catalogue record. That's great, but it doesn't necessarily tell you where Melbourne is. Is it Melbourne, Florida, or is it Melbourne, Australia? So we don't have that kind of... We're not using linked open data identifiers. We are, when we do use them, they're not necessarily sort of hooked up to the rest of the internet because of the systems that often began 20 years ago. They're still sort of catching up to things like linked open data. So the digitisation work that's going on is still kind of sketchy and patchy. And the earlier image, which I forgot to describe actually, is that's the newspaper store in West Yorkshire. It's actually a low oxygen environment, which does use robots to go in and get the volumes. So each one of these volumes is the collection of a newspaper for a single year. And that store is huge, so just to give you a sense of the size of the collections. But this image is misleading because it makes everything look sort of neatly consistent and homogenous, but actually the collections are really varied. The collections that we hold are often dependent on the whims of a rich white man a couple of hundred years ago who sent a book agent around Europe or around the UK collecting books. They might have been interested in the occult, they might have been interested in medicine, they might have been interested in classical history. The collections that we have depended on their whims, on their budgets, on whether their book agent was hungover and had a good meeting. They represent something of what was created at the time, but they don't represent everything. So there's a lot of different gaps in the collection. And we need to think about how to make those gaps legible. So there's the entire the entirety of what was published, there was what was collected then, there was what was suitable for digitization now, some things that are really big or really small are hard to digitize. If they're really fragile, they're also hard to digitize. Legally, under UK law, any manuscript that's not published is still in copyright. So sometimes when archives sound like they're being really mean about not letting you grab material, it's because legally, until 2039, when the law changes, those manuscripts are in copyright, even if they're centuries old. And a lot of archives and libraries will have a kind of risk policy around what they allow to go out, but it is legally tricky. So the collections that look really whole from a distance are often quite patchy close up. They're sort of pieces that often sit in separate systems. So if we have a manuscript for a novel that was then published, the manuscript, say Jane Austen's Persuasion, might sit in a different system than the published book, because they're catalogued by different people. So it's not easy to look across the collections as a whole. But where we want to be is to put the collections back into context, back into a sense of where they came from, how they were created. Looking at things like local newspapers, you'll often read stories and encounters that don't quite make sense because the language has moved on, things that are important to a society have changed. We want to provide more context for people accessing historical records, particularly if you're not trained as a historian or if you don't have an academic background, it can be hard to sort of work out exactly what's going on when you look at records. So if we can find ways to knit the collections back together to understand something about the place where something was created, to understand is it pre- or post-industrial revolution, what was happening in the town at that time, what were the local politics, what were the hot electoral issues, what kinds of information could we glean from other records that would help you make sense of the record that you're looking at? So everything was created at a particular time, in a particular place, by particular people, and it's usually about other people, about places, about concepts and things. So hopefully we can use things like text and data mining to pull out those concepts and help you access them when you're looking at collection records. And some of the way that we do that is by cataloguing, which is fantastic, but it's slow. Cataloguers might get through about 20 items a day because they're being really careful about how they do it. They're writing descriptions, they're sort of summarising what's going on. They're giving you a finding aid, something that says, look in this folder if you're interested in the correspondence of James Cook. It won't give you a list of things that he's discussed in the same way that you'd get it through keyword searching. It's only the things that the cataloguer or the curator has thought are important. So if you're interested in something really obscure, it's not going to be as easily findable if it wasn't described when they wrote down the original record. So we need to find a way to respect the authority and expertise of the traditional catalogers and curators while ramping up to work at scale to deal with the challenges that we have. So when I say robots, I obviously mean computers, although we do use robots in the low oxygen environments. So I look at other technologies and other sectors, text and data mining. I look at what people are doing in the world of legal practice with summarising the email communications at scale to work out which litigant knew what at what point, where the chain of authority lay. They're doing some kind of deep inferencing on that kind of text. If you apply for jobs these days, your CV will be scanned and run through and weighted by algorithms that are trying to match your skill set to the job description and also work out if you're fibbing about anything. All kinds of sectors are using these methods, things like medical research. They're trying to read through, say, 60,000 journal articles and work out for a particular disease that you might have what's the most effective treatment given other factors in your family history. They're doing this at scale because doctors can't keep up with the amount of reading that's required with the pace of research. So if we can apply these technologies to the collections of museums and libraries and archives, then it helps everyone. And I think another important reason is that something like the British Library is comparatively well-resourced, but there are tiny archives, record offices, museums and libraries around the country that don't have anything like the same resources. The British Library has about 100 IT staff. There's actually a sort of software company embedded in the heart of the library, producing software and producing systems. So if we can find ways to do this work at scale, then we can help other libraries and museums and archives do the same thing and maybe address the imbalance between well-resourced organisations and less well-resourced organisations. And I think internationally as well, if we look at the developing countries and other regions that don't have the same amount of money to digitise their cultural heritage, then maybe there's ways that we could work with them to apply the same technologies and make it so that the British Museum has the same weight online as the Museum of Benin. So it doesn't reflect the colonial history as much as it does if we just rely on who's got the most resources. So we could be clever about how we're doing things. Some of the small-scale experiments that we're doing are looking at sort of text mining is an obvious one, but I'm looking at image entity extraction from images. So this is a tool called Clarify. I think it's done remarkably well, given that this is a woodcut from a 17th century playbill. So it's an ad that was on the back of a theatre notice. It's recognised that there are people, which sounds really ordinary to us because we can look at it and see people, but the fact that it can do it with an illustration, that it can do it with an illustration that is several centuries old, that uses sort of not line drawings but woodcuts, I think is actually quite astonishing. The record isn't as good as if a cataloguer or a curator did it, so it's taking a few guesses. It's guessing that it might be an engraving, it might be a lithograph, it might be a woodcut. It's guessed vintage, which is kind of cool. They could also say retro, I suppose. A trained cataloguer would say that this is a woodcut, and it would say something. They'd say something more about the material. But this would be a great way to help people find this image. We'd need to signal, though, that these tags came from a machine, that they're best guesses by an algorithm. And ideally, we'd also label them by the version of the software, the training data set that was given to it, the date that we ran it, because if I ran this 3 months later, it's probably going to do slightly better. Or it might have learnt from a different set. So if you try this Clarify tool, it has a knack of identifying groups of people as being a demonstration, and because demonstration is linked to words like police, riot, damage, crowd control, your peaceful photo of a group of friends could be labelled as a riot. So we need to be really careful about how we label the labels that we get from software so that they don't become part of how the image is received. This is a tool called Anomaly Tracker. And it's kind of going one step beyond. Sort of entity extraction is often type what you see. So if it says Melbourne, you type in Melbourne and then you look at the context to work out if it's Melbourne, Florida or Melbourne, Australia. But this is looking for patterns. It's looking to extract meaning. It's getting much closer to the work that a curator would do when preparing for an exhibition or for a talk, or that the scholars do in reading rooms all the time. The more interpretive you get, the more subjective you get. I love it when scientists are like, we're just going to label things. I'm like, okay, that's weird, because there's no definitive label for these things. We don't know how early modern people thought about the world, so we can't label things as they saw the world. But if we could get to the point where we can make these tools available for scholars to help them interpret and understand material, to look at, say, a million books or a million images and look for patterns, then I think we'd be enabling really new kinds of scholarship and new kinds of research queries. But it does raise these questions of, if we're getting beyond the gold standard, which is someone who's spent their life dedicated to labelling Roman mosaics or understanding woodcuts and lithographs, then we need to think about how this information goes back into the catalogue. So this is a screenshot from the British Library's Flickr collection. We put a million images online from extracted from 19th century books. And people went sort of nuts, tagging them, labelling them. Those tags are fantastic because they help you find really specific images for things. But they might also get things wrong. So the great thing is they're using everyday terms. So if you don't understand the term lithographic, but you want to say, it looks kind of like oldie-fashioned line art, then they might help you find an image that matches what you've got in your head. But if they've labelled it as a lithograph and it's actually a woodcut, then someone somewhere is going to get very upset. So we need to think about how we label this, how we explain to people what's going on if we start bringing in sort of machine-generated material into catalogues. But also because these tags were created by members of the public, I think we also need to credit them. We need to say, this is work that was done by the public for the public. So we need to think about micro-attribution, micro-credit, as well as sort of micro-blame or micro-traceability and accountability. And the final challenge that we face is that the library is really focused on the deliverable unit. For the library, people walk in through the door, they line up outside the door, actually, first thing. They come into the reading room, and the book or the manuscript that they've ordered is brought to them. It's all about the deliverable unit, the thing that you can give to someone in the reading room. So if someone's ordered a particular page of a letter, you don't just get that page of a letter, you get the whole box and you have to find your way through it. So the catalogue is focused on that. It's a technology, it operationalises how we think about the world. So the library, for the longest time, for centuries, thought about what do you bring people, how do you optimise the ordering system so that you get the letter in the box that you want. But now we're getting to the point where people want to say something about that specific image on a specific page, in a specific chapter of a specific volume of a specific publication. And the library catalogue systems, really, they understand books. They sort of just about understand multi-volume books. So the level of granularity at which we can address information and knowledge in the library's collections is currently mismatched between the demands of digitisation, the demands of the public now, versus how the library has operated for a really long time. So these kinds of changes to workflow, to practices, are going to take time. They're going to take a lot of effort. So if you've got any ideas, I'd be glad to hear them. And I think to sum up, hopefully it's obvious that curators and robots should be best friends forever. They're not frenemies, they're not competing. But we need to think carefully about how we recognise and respect the expertise and authority of these people. I work in one of those organisations where everyone has multiple degrees, and that people have given their lives to learning a particular craft. And we can't just replace that, we can't automate that out. It's not like a self-service checkout. But we need to be careful that we make the most of the possibilities of machine learning, neural networks, entity recognition, while also respecting what people can do, and that we do it in ways that make sense for the public, because ultimately the public are the reason that the collections exist. So on that note, I'll say thank you and over to you.